Hi, and welcome to episode 2 of Building a Digital Future. In the last episode, we touched a little bit on the 5 pillars of BIM, or what I call the 5 pillars of BIM: reduce cost, reduce waste, reduce environmental impact, improve risk management for the businesses and the projects, and increase profit margins. I think this is quite an important topic. So in this episode, I'd like to dive into this a little bit further. So if we start with the first one then, reduced cost. I think it's widely accepted that the construction industry is a little bit behind of other industries in terms of efficiencies and, you know, cost management, okay? And being involved in architectural practices and being involved in a construction company and supporting construction companies through our organization, I can see firsthand how these inefficiencies in cost management is coming out. And if we're just looking at the digital aspect here, now, we don't have to go into quantity surveying or, you know, the investments, and we don't have to go into any of that stuff. That also plays a part. But if you're looking at building a digital future and how that affects the cost of a project, is that I used one simple example. It takes longer to draw a drawing by hand than it takes to draw the same drawing in 2D AutoCAD. Okay. And that's just making one drawing. Let's say we are making a floor plan. It takes a certain amount of time to draw that with the different pen thicknesses to get the drawing looking like a professional drawing. Then we have technologies and standards and templates and things like that in AutoCAD 2D that will make life easier drawing that on screen. So it will save some time, and the cost of producing that drawing will go down. Okay. Then if we need to make 2 drawings, we need to double that time. If we do this in 3D, then we draw the information one time and we get multiple drawings out of it. It's true that it takes longer to set up a 3D environment if you don't have the right resources. But if you start from scratch every time, it takes longer to set up a 3D environment than it takes to set up a 2D environment. That's normal. But then once you start to draw something in 3D, then you get multiple sets of information out from the same 3D model. So time is going to go down and cost is going to go down just purely from the efficiency of working in 3D compared to hand drawings. I don't think anyone disagrees with this workflow. And it's kind of showing that just by adopting small digital solutions to the workflow in the organization, cost is going to go down. And then we can add other things to that digital environment. So how do we get the number of doors coming out from the 3D model? We can get that with a simple setup. And then suddenly, if we're putting a cost to those doors, then we know how much the doors are going to cost for this project. We can start to get some cost information out of the model as well. Then we start to work with other organizations and we're starting to share this information. And if we now run clash detections on that project, it's faster to run the clash detection than it is to do manual checks of every single detail of the building. So time is going down, cost is going down because we're more efficient in the way we are working. It's true that we need to invest a little bit in software and some training and some adaptation to the business. But then that's what you do your return of investment check. Is it worth to make this change? What thing is causing issues for business right now that is, you know, the increasing your cost for your project? How do we fix that thing? Let's say you started to work in 3D instead of 2D, then you're investing in the software, you're investing in some training, and then there's going to be a little bit of from cost. But over time, you're going to reduce that cost on the projects because now you have made a clever investment and update to your business. Okay. So we can expand into this in great detail, but simple things like moving from 2D to 3D, the effect of that is a cost reduction of the project in the long run. And a time reduction on the project and the business in the long run. So obviously we can expand into this and talk about this in great detail, but I want to emphasize on that reducing cost and reducing waste and so on is not just something that is taken out of thin air. It's based on evidence that is kind of commonly accepted to be evidence for reducing costs on these projects. So to move on to the next pillar then, reduced waste. The example I'm going to give, and there are, again, many, many different examples. The example I'm going to be talking about here is project setup and mobilizing a project, because that is the situation that affects everyone involved in the project in any organization. So a contractor still needs to set up the project so they can deliver their role and responsibility for the project. But when we win a new project, there are certain things that needs to happen in the beginning. And traditionally, someone is picking up a pen and a piece of paper somewhere and start with an idea. Okay, let's say the project is now underway and we need to get going with something. And this is what happened when I was an architectural technician. So someone is picking up a pen and paper, they draw something on a piece of tissue, on a paper, on something, and then it's been handed to someone in front of the computer saying, draw that. We have a new project in the pipeline. Draw that, model that, get that going. Okay. And then the person starts with the computer in one way or another. We're not talking about resources here now, right now, but having reliable resources to start your projects from is a huge benefit to reducing waste. So let's assume that's the case here. So then the person starts to draw something on screen and it's just in some random location. And this might be a little bit technical here now, in some random location on the screen. Then you get some feedback and say, okay, change that, move that, you know, do this X, Y, Z. And then you do that. And what's happening here now in that type of workflow, and this is a very common workflow and something that I used to do as well, you know, 20 years ago, is that you start digging yourself into a hole. You take actions based on immediate needs and requirements. It's kind of a firefighting situation. Yeah, something is happening here. You act on it, you do something, and you start digging. At some point, this information that you have produced needs to be used for something other than just idea sharing. And it's very, very common to use things like SketchUp. And I can see the beauty of SketchUp because it's very, very quick to get things going. But there's going to be a point where the information can't be utilized anymore. And at that point, you might have to, this is not specifically about SketchUp. I'm not talking any same thing in negative about SketchUp here now. I'm saying that SketchUp has its place and its value. And at some point, hand drawing, pen and paper, SketchUp, or any other type of software or methodology that is utilized, at some point, there might be a position where that information can't be used anymore. And then we need to start over somewhere else and redo the information. And there we have waste, okay? Waste of time of doing something. And I'm not saying that pen and paper doesn't have its place, but it needs to have its place in the overall system. We want to try to utilize the methods and the technologies and the resources we have to hand, but it needs to be done in a way where it makes sense for the business. Otherwise, everyone goes off and do whatever they want to at any given time, and there's no coordination going on. And then some might say, but okay, but that restricts the flow of information, the freedom of expression and the design. And, you know, design doesn't just come like that. You need to have the opportunity. That's true. But what I'm saying is that from a business running point of view, although we might be doing architecture, engineering and construction, in the end, it's a business and the business have to be managed. And we need to take ownership of the processes and how we're operating within this organization and support the people in the right way so they can express themselves and they have the right tools available to them. Because otherwise, people are going to start doing what they want to, and then we're going to have waste. And that's going to affect the profit margins and it's going to increase risks to the business. And we're not going to get the ROI we intended with the investments that we did. Okay. I'm going to use one more example for the waste. It's very common to have an architectural team and a visualization team. And traditionally, there are changes coming in this industry, which is great. Traditionally, we used to model something in 2D or 3D, and then the visualization team takes some of that information and produce the videos and the renderings and the nice looking pictures of the project. Yeah. The problem with that workflow is that once you have set up a camera position of a 3D environment to run a render on, once that design changed or there's something to do with that view of picture that can't be utilized anymore, that work is a waste. That rendering was a waste. That electricity going into that rendering was a waste. Okay, so increasing the environmental impact. Instead, what we should collectively, what we should try to get to is that the architectural team produce something that is automatically connected to what the visualization team is doing live. Okay, if the architect is changing something here, the change is happening over here as well. And as the design is updating, the visualization and the VR and the videos environments are still updated. And once we have concluded some design, then we still need some time to run the renderings and let the computers do its work. But we can cut some of the waste by making the process between architecture and visualization team more effective. And that is through digital setup and technology and process and standards and training and support. Okay. So there are many, many areas where there are huge wastes inside construction, and that's something that needs to be addressed. The third point is environmental impact. How do we reduce environmental impact? We can talk about the production of cement and concrete, or the deforestation, or there are lots of areas inside construction that has an environmental impact. The shipping of timber from Eastern Europe to the UK, for example, using trucks, or flying components from one part of the world to the other part of the world using airplanes. Loads of impact everywhere. But simple things like we don't print as much anymore in the construction industry as we used to. So reducing the use of paper is one thing. And also sourcing our supply from environmentally friendly organizations like recycling and things like that. One specific example I'm going to use is how we're utilizing, or how we can, or how one could utilize technology and software for tracking CO2 emissions and locally sourced resources. So for example, if a project is using a specific type of stone on a project, and that stone can be sourced from a specific part of England, and the project is not near that location, meaning that the stone needs to be extracted and shipped to the construction site. So we might have to involve some form of transport, you know, a truck or something else. There's going to be some environmental impact. But what we can do now is to add technical parameters into the 3D environment where we can track and keep an eye on our CO2 impact on that project. So we can say if we are extracting this type of stone from this location or from this manufacturer, or from this service, or from another one, we can compare the two and say which one have the least environmental impact. And we can make an educated guess on the environmental impact of the project before we take actions. So we can choose our suppliers based on information on environmental impact, as well as cost and all the other parameters we can get out from the model. But that is one way we can utilize and should utilize technology for monitoring environmental impact. We can't do much about, you know, containers and boats and airplanes and trucks and so on, but we can use technology to make better decisions before we start a project and before we go in on site. The next point is improved risk management, and it's improved risk management for the business and the projects. And this is a really big topic, and I'm going to try to not get too into the rabbit hole of this. But what we need to remember is that BIM, ISO 19650, digital construction, all of these different terms that we're throwing around, it's all down to risk management. In the end, the bottom line is risk management. And I'm going to use an example of accreditation. So I'm not saying that everyone has to have an accreditation. What I do say is that if you do have an accreditation from a reliable source or a good accreditation body, then your business is going to show up as being a very reliable partner in a construction project, because it's going to show that you have considered and you are managing risks inside your business and on your projects to a very significant level. And I'm talking about the ISO 19650 accreditation. It's very, very closely linked to the ISO 9001, but the ISO 19650 is what we're talking about today. If you go through that accreditation process, a little bit about that process is about the 3D modeling, is about the BIM execution plan, is about your responsibility matrix and your clash detection. It's a little bit, but it doesn't really have a major impact on making sure that you comply to and pass the accreditation process. It's a little bit, but not a huge bit. But when we're talking about BIM and digital construction and construction in general these days, we mention something like BIM, and we think that, oh, this is the important bit. BIM is the center point of everything, and that's what we need to pay all our attention on. But that is not true. What's true is that we need to focus on the business and the projects and the risk we are putting the business and the projects in. And how do we mitigate those risks? That is what we need to focus on. And the accreditation is very, very good at highlighting where our weaknesses are. And it takes into account, like I said, the 3D modeling and the BIM execution plan is very important. It's important. It's a little bit important. But it also takes into account things like HR. So if we have a new project, you have won a new project, and it needs to be ISO 19650 compliant, and you need to show evidence for that you're putting a project team together that can comply to and work in those conditions. And so we can meet the requirements for ISO 19650, which we should start to understand now, is reduce cost, reduce waste, reduce environmental impact, improve risk management, increase profit margins. Can this team collectively work with other teams collectively to achieve those outcomes? Yes or no? And if they can't, what type of training do they need? What type of resources do they need? That's an HR issue. So HR work in close relation to the business to ensure that we can get these outcomes for these projects. And if HR can do that, and the BIM manager can do their role, and the architectural director can do their role, collectively, we are now reducing cost, reducing waste, and so on the project. And that is risk management. So BIM, ISO 19650, digital construction, all of this stuff is about reducing risks for the business and the projects. And we do that partly with digitalization, with technology, with process, with communication, and so on. The last point is the increased profit margins. Okay, so this is kind of the dashboard or KPI point. We don't know if we're going to increase profit margins when we're starting on the project. We're hoping we will, and we can set a target, but we need to monitor that, and we need to do lessons learned after the project to find out, did we increase the profit margin or did we lose money on this project? And hopefully along the way, we can see indicators for which direction we're going. Are we starting to lose money? Are we starting to, you know, increase profit margins here? Yes or no, yeah. But that depends on your processes and your standards and your communication and your collaboration and the whole operation of that project. Keep in mind, reducing the risks, yeah? And when we win that project in the beginning, if we can say, what type of project is this and what is my role and responsibility? And you collect from your pool of resources the relevant resources for that type of project at this point for the role and responsibility that you have as a business, and you take those resources and you apply that to that project, then you will reduce cost and you will reduce waste and you will reduce environmental impact if you have the right resources in place. And if you think of the project in those terms, automatically you are reducing the risks. And if you're working in this workflow, applying the right type of resources using digitalization, obviously, then your profit margins will go up. It's an after effect. And if you do all of these things, if you approach your projects and your businesses in this way, and you run your lessons learned, then you're finding out what didn't work at the end. And then you know that this is now a risk to the next project. Then you do something to mitigate that risk for the next project. And so you're reducing your risk next time. This whole concept is what BIM is about. This makes something BIM. It makes something ISO 19650 compliant. Okay, and then you're getting the results that you're trying to get as a business owner, reduce cost, reduce waste, and so on, as a result of doing it in this way. Not by saying upfront, this is BIM or this is not BIM. You're saying this is a project, and in this project, I'm trying to reduce cost, reduce waste, and the other pillars. And how do I do that? By having good resources that you're picking from, so you're nurturing your business and your project in this direction so you can see your profit margins increasing at the end. So now having a relatively good understanding on what these five pillars of BIM that I call it is about, and the type of mindset that we have as business owners and project runners to achieve these outcomes, we're now going to take a quick look at the history to see how the contradiction ended up. So I'm going to start from 2007, because that's when BS 1192 was published. And in my opinion, I was very excited when that document was published. It's a document that was kind of indicating for business owners saying, we are moving the industry in a certain direction. And we want to prepare individual organizations to be ready to collaborate. And to be in the position to be ready to collaborate, you need to have things like a sophisticated 2D CAD platform, like AutoCAD, for example. And you need to have good drawing production coming out from those 2D platforms. And to be honest, in my experience, that's not really ever been a concern, because organizations have been spending like years and years and years developing their CAD standards and having CAD technicians and things like that on in their organizations to handle that setup. So usually that is very sophisticated in my experience. You needed to have some 3D capability, working in SketchUp, let's say, or MicroStation 3D or something else, but nothing sophisticated, but some 3D capability, yeah. And from the BS Langer 2 point of view, you need to have your CAD standards, your drawing production. You need to have your naming convention. So you need to name files in a certain way. And this was new, not a very user-friendly way of naming things, but it was a way for computers to easily understand the information we're dealing with. We needed to have a geo-coordination system. So this can become too technical too quickly. So what I'm going to say is that each software have a capacity to understand geometry on the screen and making the relevant calculations in the background to display this geometry in a correct way. So the user, so the person, can see the information on screen and saying, yeah, that's what I drew. When we're collaborating between organizations, we need to make sure that when we share data, 2D or 3D, between organizations, when we are putting one drawing from one organization into my screen or my computer, I need to make sure that it's landing in the correct location. Otherwise, I can't check design problems. I can't check if a column is going through a door, for example. Yeah. So I need to maybe to line these two things up on my computer so I can trust the information. And that's called geo-coordination. And that works within a certain range inside the software where the software feels comfortable processing this information. And it's a very complicated system to set up to make work between organizations, but it's a critical one. And it's part of BS1192 to have that geo-coordination system in place. We need to have a way of sharing data. And I'm not talking about cloud service providers who are saying, please store your information on my service. Back in 2007, that wasn't how we shared data. Back in 2007, we printed the drawing, sent it with couriers, or started to have some digitalization, but it was very common to send drawings with couriers and paper drawings, yeah. So how you're sharing the information wasn't really important, but what was important was that where do you store your information? Is it stored in a secure environment where it's not going to affect other projects, or where other projects or other people can access this information? So it's a security issue more than anything. Yeah. And when you have information stored in this specific location, it was called work in progress, then that information is not suitable for anything. And we need to make sure that when we're sending information outside our organizations, like when we print in the drawings, we print the drawings on paper and we just check it before it leaves with the courier to see that is the correct drawing. And then we send it and then it's received and it's being used. Okay. But now in digital format, we need to do the same process. So we need to have a validation process saying, is this digital version of a drawing, is it suitable for the person going to receive it? So we have a validation checklist. We're checking, you know, is it named correctly? Is it the right type of geometry? Does the drawing look like a professional drawing? And is it geo-coordinated? Yeah, so we're checking off these validation points. And then we share this data in one way or another. That way of storing data and validating data was called Common Data Environment, the CDE. So it was a process of checking so the information was correct and suitable for purpose. That was part of BS1192. And there was a couple of other things in BS1192 in terms of, you know, suitability codes and what can this information be used for, and revisions and numbers. Make sure that information leaving the office is standardized in one way or another. If you had these things in place, BS1192 and the 3D modeling and CAD standards, if you had these things in place back before 2016, you were considered BIM level 1 compliant. Your office was ready, or in a position to be ready to go to the next level of collaborating with other offices in a certain way. And that certain way was called BIM level 2. And to be BIM level 2 compliant, you needed to have, first of all, BIM level 1. And BIM level 1 was practical. You know, do you have CAD standards? Can you print drawings? Can you work in 3D? It was very practical, and you can show evidence of that. With BIM level 2, it was very academic. And to be BIM level 2 compliant, you need to have, in addition then, a BIM compliant software like Revit, like Ecosim, like Vectorworks, like ArchiCAD. Okay, they all pretty much do the same thing. And those type of software, you can store your geometry, you can produce your information in 3D, you can export drawings, you can export schedules and some other data related to the project. So much more effective way of working. And you also need to have a document called the BIM execution plan. You need to have a document called the responsibility matrix. You need another document called, it used to be called an employer's information requirement back then, but now it's called an exchange information requirement, EIR for short, same type of documents. You need to have these three documents. You need to have a role called an information manager. And if you had these things in place, then you were ticking the tick box of being BIM level 2 compliant. And the problem here was that you could just download a copy of Revit. You could download copies of a BIM execution plan, or even take a document and call it BIM execution plan. Back in 2016, a BIM execution plan template was very short. And if you had these kind of basic sections in that document, it could be called a BIM execution plan. But it was very, very academic. You could download a version of a responsibility matrix from somewhere, and the EIR document needs to come from the developer, and that was very, that's a whole different discussion for now, so I'm going to leave that for now. And you can appoint someone to be an information manager, saying, you are now an information manager, as well as an architect, okay? If you did these things, and you had that confirmed, and you had some document in your office saying, yeah, this is what we have now, BIM level 2 compliant, okay? Super academic. The problem was that then you land the project, and now you need to comply to BIM level 2, and nothing was working. Things weren't coordinated, there was delays on the drawings, project weren't set up properly, information management workflows weren't in place, no one took responsibilities over certain areas of the project. There was a BIM execution plan that was copied from one project to the other, wrong information, wrong deliverables, complete mess, but still BIM level 2 compliant. But we didn't reduce cost, we didn't reduce waste, we didn't reduce environmental impact, we didn't reduce risks, and we certainly didn't increase the profit margins, but it was BIM level 2. So here's the contradiction. Traditionally, with software companies being very good at marketing, saying, use this thing, do these kind of things, and then it's BIM, and then having the testing period before 2016 up to 2016 when BIM level 2 became mandatory, still an academic tick box exercise that was now mandatory on certain projects. And the knowledge and the belief of what BIM was in the industry has now grown into, you either have to use a specific type of software, or if you use this type of software, then it's BIM. And as long as you have a BIM execution plan, the responsibility matrix, and the information manager, and maybe an EIR somewhere along the lines, then it's BIM level 2 and it's all good. Okay. But we didn't get the effect. Yeah. So that knowledge still exists in the industry today. That's why we hear often organizations saying this project is BIM and this isn't BIM, you know, and making those distinct decisions about the project up front based on knowledge that predates 2016. But today we need to stop thinking about the world in these ways. We need to look at, what is my business doing and how do I deliver these projects so I achieve these outcomes? So I mentioned that in 2016, BIM level 2 became mandatory in a certain type of projects. Those certain type of projects were government-funded projects to a certain value. I think it was 5 million back then. To work on those projects, you needed to tick these tick boxes. You needed to have a BIM execution plan. You need to have a compliance software. You need to have BIM level 1, obviously. You need to have the responsibility method and so on. And then on those projects, maybe the government issued this EIR document. And if you did that, then yeah, you were BIM level 2 compliant. The purpose of making BIM level 2 mandatory on those projects, this is the government initiative, was that the government needed to reduce cost, reduce waste, reduce environmental impact, improve risk management, and increase the profit margins for their own projects. So the government said, how can we do that? Well, digitalization sounds good. Let's try that out. And then the whole thing about BIM was kind of taking effect, and ISO 19650, you know, 2011 was published. So this has been a government project or intention for a very, very long time. If you want to geek out like I do, reading the government's industrial strategies and construction strategy documents from like way early 2000, it's very, very clear on what the intentions are, but it's a very long game we're playing here. So 2007, it kind of started with people on the floor like me. And 2016 came around saying, okay, now we have some beta versions of certain things in place. Now we're going to apply that in a more kind of robust way, still BIM level 2. And people like me running about on the projects, testing things out, seeing what's working, what's not working. And it's clear that it was working, because it was leading up then to 2018, where we had enough evidence for things actually working. So BIM level 2 then became ISO 19650. So from end of 2018, BIM level 2 and the associated documents past 1192, those documents and BIM level 2 kind of ceased to exist. And ISO 9650 is now the foundation we should all follow, with enough evidence saying if we do things a certain way, we get really good outcomes. So in this transition from, you know, 2007, 2016, 2018, in the UK, there was a massive, specifically leading up to 2016 and then up to 2018, was a massive wave of everyone to be on the BIM level 2 compliancy tick box. There was surveys published by NBS every year of showing statistics on how organizations adopted to new ways of working and BIM level 2 and digitalization and what software they used and all that stuff. So we had all the statistics every single year. And at that time, I was right in the middle of everything. I was project technology manager, BIM manager, consultant during these years, and being on the floors, supporting the people and the projects, you know, in real life, day to day. And then at the same time, seeing these publications coming out, I could clearly tell that what the numbers showed was not what was happening in reality. People just ticking tick boxes to get the statistics. It looks good. It looks like the UK is now, you know, 78% BIM level 2 compliant. But then when we're standing on the floors with the project and the people, actually nothing is working. So that was completely misleading. But from an academic tick boxing exercise of, do we have the software? Do we have a BIM execution plan? Do we have the responsibility? Do we tick the tick boxes? Sure, it was all true. But when it comes down to it, can we deliver projects by reducing cost and reducing waste and so on? No, we couldn't. So there needs to be kind of a lot of support and training and changes and on the fly technical innovations happening on these projects on a daily basis to actually make this work. But that thing never really made it into statistics. However, that type of work, you know, from me and from my peer groups, that actually made a difference for the government feeling like, actually, this is working. We are getting results because geeks are running about on, you know, on the floors and doing all these things, and we're getting the results. And that is the evidence showing that this is actually working. So that opened up a whole, you know, not new industry, but a whole new sales opportunity of selling BIM level 2 as a consultant. And that's what I did for some time, yeah. And it was probably more beneficial for the consultants than it was from the customers. So we had, and I'm saying we because I was writing in it, we had all the jargon, we said all the right things. We had the resources, we had the expertise, the detailed expertise of the technical things, things that normal people don't understand and shouldn't understand, you know. But that was used as a sales pitch. And there was lots of, this is a bit political, and I apologize, but I'm not saying that we were the worst people on the planet. But I'm saying there was a fair amount of this scaremongering going on, and other organizations was worse than others. And I like to believe that personally, because I'm involved with the people and the projects, I like to believe that I was probably on the lower spectrum of the worst. But overall, it was still pretty bad, in my opinion, of scaremongering customers to buy things that really didn't make that much impact on what their actual outcomes were. We have to take into account here as well that this was a transition period. This was a learning period. So some investments going in from these organizations was contributing to the knowledge we now have today. So overall, I'm guessing it was good investments. But from an individual business point of view, that is not what they bought. They didn't buy into the overall investment of the UK construction. They bought into things that's going to happen in their business so they can make more money and they can deliver better projects. And we saw a lot of that not happening. Lots of problems along the way. Yeah. So it was a very, and still is a very good market for BIM consultants, if I'm calling them that, of selling this implementation thing that is kind of semi-customized to, you know, have the customer specific requirements considered, like, you know, what's your line weights and line patterns for your CAD standards, and having, make sure you have your the logos on your documents. But the foundation is very ISO 19650 BIM level 2 driven, and that is the job of the BIM consultant, implementing documents, process, technology, solutions that meets the BIM standards, and not necessarily the standards and requirements of the projects and the people for the business to thrive, but just ticking the box of, does it meet BIM? Yes or no? Yes, it does. Okay, job done. Please pay. I don't like that approach. And that is something that is happening widely by a lot of organizations that's making a lot of money on this. Personally, I think it's wrong. Everything that we talked about in this episode has been to do with the experience and what we did in the UK, you know, from 2007 up to, you know, 2018 and up to today. So it's been a learning curve, it's been a transition period, it's been an industry kind of revolution, and it's all good, and we're definitely getting the right type of outcome from this change. There's no question about that. So that's great for us here in the UK, and especially in London. It's great for us. Now, the UK government have bigger ambitions than just, you know, reducing costs and so on their own projects in the UK. Now it's about tapping into emerging economies, exporting, using one of the key industries in the UK and using as an export product into emerging economies. Okay. And partnerships has already been set up between the UK government and a selection of nations who wants to drive their digital construction kind of innovation and process in their own countries, because there is a clear benefit of doing things in a certain way. And if nothing else, we can see that because the private sector picked up on this faster than the UK government picked up on their own initiative. So we can see across the board, digitalization, ISO 19650, 3D modeling, all that stuff is clear benefits to businesses. Okay. And now these emerging economies, the governments in these emerging economies, they want to be part of this as well. And UK now wants to be part from a financial point of view of exporting these services into these emerging economies. And also, that is also great because it will nurture these emerging economies even more. Here's the problem. These emerging economies, these people like me, people like the architects that I've been supporting over the years, they cannot afford to go through the same journey as we did in the UK. They can't afford to start back in 2007 like we did and go through the same journey with the same problems and milestones and difficulties that we did. It's too expensive for businesses in emerging economies to take on that load. Okay. So what we need to do now, and I think to be a responsible business owner or being responsible business owners, we need to enable emerging economies, since we're going to try to establish partnerships now with exporting our services to these nations. We need to enable the businesses on the ground in these nations to fast track past all the problems that we learned in the UK. They shouldn't have to go through the same thing. They should just get the end product. The thing that works, the solution, should be handed over pretty much to these businesses in these emerging economies in a way that is suitable for their local economies. So packaging up what we have learned over the years into some solution that is applicable and scalable in these nations to that economy. That, I think, is what our mission should be. In the next episode, we are going to talk about resetting the world of BIM. What do we need to do to gain these benefits out of the systems that we are investing in?